Billy Angel's One, Law for All, is at once a legal ethics coming-of-age story, a political conspiracy thriller, and a strangely tender tale of friendship built under pressure. At its center is Kitiona Tuafa, a young Samoan woman whose life has been shattered by the deliberate burning of her family home in American Samoa. Her father had stood up to unsafe asbestos-related labor practices at the Motorhead Factory, a subsidiary tied to the larger Ameristar corporate empire. And in the novel's moral universe, that act of resistance made him dangerous to powerful people. The fire that killed most of Kitiona's family was not an accident, and the entire book turns on the effort to prove that fact, connect it to corporate and political power, and force the people responsible to answer for it. The novel opens with a prologue that immediately establishes the brutality of the original crime. In the pre-dawn darkness, a Samoan community gathers around a burning home while the Tuafa family is trapped inside. The language is visceral. Flames, smoke, the smell of bird flesh, the helplessness of the neighbors. But the prologue also gives the reader the cold, hidden side of the crime. Two men stand in the shadows, watching to make sure no one escapes. The younger one has drilled holes under the house and pumped fire gel into the flooring to accelerate the blaze from inside, while the older one has soaked the exterior walls. The fire is not only murder, but a calculated operation. From the first pages, Angel makes clear that the true story will be about systems of concealment, not just a single act of violence. The book then shifts to San Francisco, where the first thread of the narrative is introduced through a lighter, almost comic setting, Original Joe's, a legendary restaurant where law student Max spots a mysterious woman with a single chopstick marked King Ling. This chance encounter becomes the first clue in a much larger story. Mac, Jimmy, Carol, and Juan begin as ordinary law students trying to survive classes, study sessions, and exams. They are young, argumentative, idealistic, and full of theories. Their conversations about justice often start in the abstract, with debates about the fairness of the legal system, corporate power, and politics. But those conversations gradually become action. In the early chapters, the book uses their study sessions to show how legal reasoning works in practice. They analyze fictional case problems, argue over facts, and learn to separate feelings from evidence. That training turns out to be essential. The mystery of the chopstick leads Mac back to Original Joe's and into contact with Kitiona Tuafa. She has recently moved to San Francisco, trying to hide from men who have already tried to kill her near the site of the fire and again in the city, first in a temporary shelter situation, and then in a small third-floor flat near Azalea Market, always watching for the men who are tailing her. She is young, beautiful, proud, and visibly exhausted by fear. She keeps her motorcycle inconspicuous, carries a gun in her backpack, and tries to build a new life from nothing. The book presents her as both vulnerable and formidable. She is grieving, but she is not passive. Ben Green enters the story as the crucial adult presence. A retired lawyer, he is not looking for a case. But when Kitiona approaches him for help, he sees more than a distressed young woman. He sees a set of facts that might be organized into a legal strategy. Their relationship becomes one of the book's central emotional and intellectual engines. Kitiona tells Ben about the fire, about her father's resistance to the company's asbestos practices and union suppression, and about her belief that Ameristar is somehow connected to the murders. Ben does not treat her story as sentiment. He treats it as a hypothesis. He asks questions the way a scientist would, demanding timelines, motives, and supporting details. That methodical skepticism is what makes him trustworthy. He is compassionate, but he also knows that justice in a corporate case requires structure, proof, and patience. Once Ben commits to helping Kitiona, the story changes shape. What begins as a lone quest becomes a group project. Mac, Jimmy, Juan, and Carol, who first knew each other as classmates, are pulled into the investigation. Ben turns their youthful energy into something useful. He assigns them research tasks. One group examines Ameristar's corporate structure and records. Another looks into Senator Bonnie Giardina's legislative and political connections, while others gather information from the street. This is one of the novel's most distinctive pleasures, watching a team of law students turn into improvisational investigators. They build walls of notes, timelines, and printouts. They work in kitchens, libraries, apartments, and restaurants. The investigation becomes a living collage. Their legal education is not a backdrop. It is the mechanism that lets them understand how to convert suspicion into case theory. As the young team digs deeper, the corporate and political conspiracy comes into focus. Ameristar is presented as a respectable multinational with a polished public image. but underneath that facade is a ruthless willingness to use coercion, labor suppression, and financial pressure to protect profits. Motorhead, the subsidiary at the center of the fire, had been manufacturing brake lining glue using asbestos. Kitayona's father pushed back when he understood the danger to workers and resisted efforts to block unionization. That defiance made him a target. The company's executives and their hired intermediaries knew exactly what they were doing when they destroyed the Tuafa family. And the deeper the team looks, the more they see that the fire was not an isolated atrocity. It was part of a system that included labor intimidation, political favors, and the suppression of inconvenient truths. Senator Bonnie Giardina embodies the corruption at the political level. Angel constructs her as a woman of immense polish and appetite, someone who learned to trade on influence long before she entered adulthood. The book gives us her grooming from childhood. Her father, a politician, teaches her the logic of reciprocity, and by age 9, she already understands back-scratching politics as a natural language. That early lesson blossoms into a career defined by manipulation. In Washington, she uses her congressional power, her sexual charisma, and her access to the machinery of government to protect Ameristar and keep the FBI away from Motorhead-related trouble. Her public persona is that of a powerful, competent senator. Her private life is a haze of scotch, cigarettes, affairs, vanity, and self-justification. The contrast between image and reality is one of the book's central themes. Bonnie is always performing, and the novel makes us watch the performance crack. The same contrast governs Ameristar's leadership. Simon Wooster, the CEO, and Michael Brothers, the board president, are presented as executives who speak in the language of shareholder value, market pressure, and corporate efficiency. They want to sell Motorhead, preserve profits, and avoid scandal. But they are also trapped by the very corruption they helped build. The company is not simply evil in a cartoonish sense. It is a machine of incentives, cover-ups, and fear. The boardrooms, limousine rides, and closed meetings are as much scenes of moral decay as the burned house in Samoa. The executives worry less about truth than about public relations, stock price, and the timing of disclosures. Their respectability is a costume. Surveillance becomes the novel's practical and symbolic battleground. Both sides monitor each other obsessively. Ben's team is watched by ex-military security men, apartment stakeouts, and hidden devices. Bob Turnbull, the street-savvy ally, keeps track of vans, tail cars, and suspicious pedestrians, while Ameristar's security people use cameras, bugging, and backup teams to track the young investigators. Carol and Anna in Washington become a parallel intelligence channel, gathering gossip from the political world and feeding it back into the case. Even the phone is never just a phone. It is a source of leverage, tracing, and fear. As the team grows more effective, the other side responds with more aggression. The book treats counter-surveillance not as a gimmick, but as a sign that the investigation is nearing something real. The strategy that eventually emerges is the story float, one of the most interesting devices in the book. Ben realizes that they may not be able to prove everything directly at first, so instead they construct a believable version of events and leak it strategically. The goal is to make someone on the Ameristar side panic, react, or reveal knowledge they should not have. This is where the younger team's creativity and Ben's legal experience fit together. They develop a story containing enough real facts to make the corporate and political players think they are exposed. Carol and Anna help float the story through DC social and media channels. The effect is explosive. The rumor reaches Washington, makes its way through political and corporate circles, and begins to shake people into motion. The book shows how narrative itself can be a weapon when formal proof is still incomplete. As the float spreads, the pressure escalates. Kitayona is nearly killed in a bombing attempt, and the stakes become brutally physical. The team has to move her, hide her, protect her, and keep working, while knowing that the people they are fighting are willing to use murder again. Giardina's camp reacts with fear and rage. Her assistant Aaron, her husband Simon, and Ameristar security all scramble to contain the damage. The novel repeatedly shows how the powerful behave when threatened. They deny, reroute blame, issue tactical statements, and try to outrun the truth with money and intimidation. But each attempt at control only exposes more weakness. The senator's private life becomes less stable. Her assistant Eric resigns, and her carefully maintained image becomes harder to sustain. One of the most striking stretches of the book is the aftermath of Giardina's death. Her sudden collapse changes the landscape overnight. On the surface, it seems to simplify things. The senator was the most visible political protector of the conspiracy, and with her gone, Ameristar no longer has to funnel money into her orbit or rely on her legislative shield. But the death also creates uncertainty. The board now has to reassess the Motorhead sale, the labor situation, and the risk of scandal. The question becomes whether justice is still possible when the key political node has been removed. The answer is complicated. Giardina's death does not erase the fire or absolve the company, but it does shift the settlement calculus. The settlement phase is where the book's legal and moral themes come together most fully. Ben, with support from Lacey and the others, pushes Ameristar toward a financial resolution that is large enough to matter and structured in a way that helps Gationa reclaim her life. The board debates the costs, the tax consequences, the public relations damage, and the possibility of a scandal. They settle on a figure of $25 million, tax-free, which the team recognizes as a victory not just in money but in principle. It is a number that reflects the seriousness of the crime, while also acknowledging the limits of what the legal system can extract from powerful institutions. The settlement is not presented as full justice. It cannot restore the dead. But it does force acknowledgement, accountability, and material support. The final chapters make clear that the emotional payoff belongs as much to Gationa as to the investigators. She has spent the book as a woman living in fear, carrying grief, and trying to find the people responsible for her family's murder. By the end, she has some measure of safety, resources, and agency. The novel does not pretend that money is enough, but it shows that money can create the conditions for survival, mobility, and a future. Kitiona's calm at the end is not simple happiness. It is the hard-won peace of someone who has been given back a life. Mac's awkward affection for her, the group's teasing, the jokes about chicken salad and diamond rings, and the eventual move toward a shared future, all reflect the book's refusal to end in pure tragedy. It wants to honor grief without being trapped by it. The epilogue and final title chapter, One Law for All, tie the book's themes together. The phrase suggests both legal idealism and moral aspiration. One law, for everyone, without special treatment for the rich, the powerful, or the politically connected. The irony, of course, is that most of the novel has shown how far reality falls short of that promise. Senator Giardina, Ameristar, and their allies have all lived as though laws are flexible for those who can buy influence or intimidate opponents. But the student investigators, Ben and Gationa, insist on a different principle. Law should mean something universal. It should be a tool for truth rather than concealment, for accountability rather than impunity. In that sense, the title is both a statement and a challenge. What makes One Law for All engaging is that it refuses to separate intellect from emotion. It is a book about legal thinking, but also about desire, loyalty, embarrassment, friendship, class, race, and the strange comedy of young people trying to do serious work. The students' arguments about politics and justice often sound naive, but the novel respects their energy. Ben gives that energy shape. Gationa gives it purpose. And the villains, for all their wealth and polish, are undone by the very thing they think they control best, the story. By the end, the reader understands that the real battle was never only about one burned house or one corrupt senator. It was about whether ordinary people, armed with facts, courage, and each other, can force a system built on secrets to tell the truth.